behavior. Solution selling clearly requires a team approach, so sales executives who cast themselves as heroic individualists will need to develop new patterns of behavior to succeed in the new environment. The leadership assessment summary gives an overview of those in the group who have high potential and those who are promotable. Those who have both qualities are placed in the upper right-hand quadrant. Similarly, it shows who exceeds standards in terms of performance but need improvement in behavior, as well as those who are below standard in both areas. The leadership assessment summary is the bottom line and end result of several key pieces of information and backup, including the continuous improvement summary, the succession depth analysis, and the retention risk analysis. The continuous improvement summary. The continuous improvement summary looks much like a traditional performance appraisal. Where it differs is that it not only captures the key performance highlights, both accomplishments and missed targets, but includes clear, specific, and useful information on development needs. The continuous improvement summary helps the individual become a better performer. As one example, let's consider Susan James, a marketing vice president who was identified as a high potential person in the leadership assessment summary. Her 2001 performance highlights included developing both the aftermarket strategy for the new solution selling environment and the marketing and profit improvement strategy for the European market. Her 2002 challenges include continued execution of the aftermarket strategy, especially supply chain management. While she's customer-focused and knows the industry and its products, she still has important development needs. She has to work on building teams through coaching, and she has to move to upgrade the skills of weak performers, especially those serving the European market. Since there will be significant new hiring for the solution selling program, she has to make sure she effectively integrates new people. The continuous improvement summary forms the foundation of succession, the talent in the organization that can move to higher levels of responsibility. Susan James will be in her current job for up to 2 more years. She's definitely pegged as a comer, who will be a division president in the very near future. Succession depth and retention risk analysis. Analyzing succession depth and retention risk are the essence of talent planning and building a leadership pipeline of high potential people. Taken together, they put meaning into the slogan, "People are our most important asset," and are the foundation for discussing individual needs as well as lateral and upward job moves. They also focus on what needs to be done to retain critical people and replace those who leave unexpectedly, are promoted, or who fail. The retention risk analysis looks at a person's marketability, her potential for mobility, and the risk a business faces if she leaves. If she's been in her existing job too long, she's likely to feel blocked from moving upward and hence susceptible to headhunter calls. Susan James, for example, is critical to the future of the business and its success in executing the new mission of solutions and aftermarket sales. XYZ will take several actions to retain her. It will give her immediate recognition and rewards for her accomplishments, and make sure she knows about the company's future plans. It will also give serious consideration to unblocking a higher-level position so she can continue to grow. Succession depth analysis determines whether the company has enough high-potential people to fill key positions. It also looks at whether there are high-potential people in the wrong jobs, and whether key people will be lost if a job is not unblocked for them. The people process at companies like GE, Colgate, and Honeywell provide their bench strength. In the mid-1990s, when it had become clear that GE was the world's best producer of leadership talent, its division presidents were all retention risks. They were listed in the annual report and constantly circled by the top headhunters. GE's people process provided a forum for how to retain them by both gathering data and providing financial rewards such as stock grants that could not be cashed until retirement. When a key person does leave, however, the process almost always provides a needed replacement within 24 hours. For example, when Larry Johnson, the president of GE's appliance division, announced in spring 2001 that he was leaving to become CEO of the Albertsons chain, GE named his successor on the same day. It was also able to announce, on the same day, who would fill all positions created by the domino effect of related promotions. Identifying high potential and promotable people avoids two dangers. One is organizational inertia, keeping people in the same jobs for too long, a common practice in some industries. The other is moving people up too quickly, such as the 20-somethings at dot-com companies who didn't have the experience to handle senior management positions.
The trade-offs between the need for succession depth, retention of future leaders, and meeting immediate economic realities can cause a great deal of trouble if a business doesn't have a strong leadership pipeline based on good information. One example of this recently took place in a large, diversified company. The company's second-largest division, in terms of the profits it produced, had been on an expansion path. But business conditions had deteriorated. The industry's growth had turned negative, with little likelihood of an upturn for two or more years. The division president was due to retire in another year, and his successor would face tough challenges. Along with taking other cost-cutting measures, he would need to reorganize the division from P&L centers for each product line, each with its own marketing, legal, HR, finance, and engineering staffs, into a functional organization with central staffs. There were two candidates for the job, Paul, 40 years old and extremely successful marketer who was popular with customers and colleagues, came from within the division and was considered a high potential candidate for the CEO job within 7 to 8 years. Roger, in his mid-50s, was a seasoned manager with a strong success record in two other divisions. With 6 years to go until retirement, he was not a CEO candidate. The CEO strongly favored Paul, but the division president had developed doubts about the man as business conditions got tougher. Paul, he pointed out, had never held a P&L responsibility, and his evaluation raised doubts about whether he would be tough enough to handle a situation that requires cost-cutting, resizing, negotiating with suppliers, and even repositioning the business. Roger, he felt, would be more likely to succeed. He had handled several P&L responsibilities where he showed the ability to make the tough decisions. But the CEO worried that the company would be blocking the succession pipeline if Roger got the job. Paul would most likely leave, and the other talented people trying to move into the pipeline would have second thoughts about their future with the company. Moreover, he added, aspiring leaders in the pipeline might perceive the company as too risk-averse if it chose Roger. "Let's test Paul," said the CEO. "He's so good, I think he will grow into the job." The division president demurred. "If he doesn't rise to the job, we could have a disaster," he responded. "This division is crucial to the company's performance, and Wall Street has gotten unforgiving. And honestly, I don't think he should be in the succession pool anyway." The CEO and the group executive decided they needed more viewpoints. They brought in the CFO and the head of HR. The four debated heatedly at times for 4 hours. At the end, they agreed that Paul was not the person for the job. The lengthy discussions revealed the flaw in his record of success. The record was accurate as far as it went. But he had never had to face adverse conditions. And in exploring his personality traits, the group concluded that adversity was a test he would fail. What's more, they were persuaded that he should no longer be a potential CEO candidate. The senior leadership team learned an important lesson from the experience. Having realized that they had overestimated the abilities of someone seen as a high-potential CEO candidate, they went on to develop rigorous new criteria for the leadership pipeline.
Talent Review at Honeywell. The talent review is the main social operating mechanism of the people process. At Honeywell, these reviews are called Management Resource Reviews, MRRs. They are held in the spring and fall for 2 days between the strategy and operation sessions. They are conducted throughout the organization, starting at the highest levels by the CEO and down in the business units by their general managers. They evaluate people in current jobs and those who are available to succeed them. They identify people who should be moved in the next year because of their potential. The talent review also talks about people who are not succeeding and debates alternatives. Would coaching help them, or are they in the wrong jobs? The leaders have to show they have backup candidates for people who might leave or be moved. Besides covering individual performances, the talent review also addresses organization design, general talent development, and skill gaps that the organization needs to fill in order to execute its strategy. Honeywell's leaders spend a lot of time preparing for MRR meetings. They're responsible for their direct reports and for the direct reports of those people as well. They have to be ready not only to present their views, but to discuss them and to argue their case if others disagree. They're asked what they're doing to develop their people. Are those people growing and maturing? Why are poor performers doing badly? And what are the leaders doing about it? What have they been doing for each individual who's been promised help with development needs? Did he or she get a coach or another assignment to work out the deficiency? Those attending the talent review meetings have to submit their assessments in writing a week before the meeting. The assessments that don't measure up are sent back for rework. Maintaining the honesty of the process is mandatory.
Why would an assessment be sent back? Maybe the words are lukewarm. The assessor says a person is doing wonderfully, and under the heading for development needs, he puts none. Who is this manager kidding? Michael Jordan had some development needs. How can a leader help a person when he tells her she's got no development needs? I tell these people, go back and do the assessment you've been asked to do. Or an assessment might be perfectly candid, but the executive hasn't reviewed it with the person being assessed. That too is unacceptable. Sometimes important issues are omitted in the assessments and then brought up in the meeting. Let's assume that an individual's assessment listed under development needs is indecisive, impetuous, doesn't listen. Then during the meeting, the person who submitted the assessment adds, he's also got other behavior problems. Why weren't they on the sheet? How does the manager know about them? I tell him. Don't talk to me about things that you haven't talked to him about. If he's got a behavioral problem, put it on the sheet and have him acknowledge it. An extremely important purpose of these meetings is to provide multiple viewpoints and judgments. Even the best leaders can't always rely on their own impressions. People struggle honestly with assessment out of a concern that their views are apt to be subjective to some degree. But the dynamics of judgment change dramatically in a group when several people who've watched the same person over time pool their observations in robust dialogue. Subjective views become objective.
When it comes to talent reviews, you would be amazed at how accurately, thoroughly, and quickly a group can pinpoint the critical issues. At one company I advised, a senior executive was meeting with a group to consider Walt, a 34-year-old marketing vice president for a job in operations. Walt was smart, personable, high energy, and honest. He spoke eloquently. The board loved him. He was on the short list of candidates to be groomed for succession to CEO. The CEO himself felt Walt was probably at the head of the list. The operating job would be an important step in that progression. Several members of the group had observed Walt over time, and they had assessments from others down the line who had worked closely with him. As they talked about him, three behaviors emerged that had not been revealed in Walt's appraisals, and which the CEO had not really focused on. First, it turned out that while Walt was full of ideas, He didn't rigorously follow through on them. He left the execution to others. Second, he was so eager to win big orders that he would consistently ignore the capital investment implications that others would point out to him. A serious mistake in a company that was capital intensive with high debt and low profit margins. Finally, he loved to go after mega projects, but he avoided smaller ones that would be more profitable and less capital intensive. These were very specific behaviors, observed by line leaders who worked closely with the man, not round words or abstract checklist items. In less than 20 minutes, the executives, including the CEO, reached the conclusion that Walt needed further development and wasn't right either for the operating job or as a CEO candidate. Get five people who know the person together in a room. Get them to open up, to share and argue their observations, and to reach a conclusion. The diagnosis will come from the convergence of their diverse views. There is the core of your robust people process.
When I'm making an assessment, I may not be able to characterize my thoughts as clearly as I want to. If I expose them to the rest of my leadership group, the chances are they will distill those thoughts more accurately. For example, in one talent review group, four of us were assessing Will, an inspiring engineer we'd hired from outside 3 years before. He was the head of a business unit. From the data put before us by his leader, we went through the pluses. He was technically savvy. He understood customer satisfaction. He was open to suggestions. He was creative. People liked the environment that he created and a host of other positive things. The negatives, one, he wasn't familiar enough with numbers and often fell short of results. Two, he was not business mature. He was basically mature, but not with business matters. Three, he continued to need good coaching. The takeaway conclusion, Will had very good potential, but needed development. Well, we all mostly agreed except one man who said, "You know, Will's doing better in his financial results than you suggest he is. If you look at the situation, he's had to overcome a technical problem with a product and a field quality issue as well." We debated that for a few minutes, and I said, "He hasn't made his commitments. Now, you said there are reasons for it, and maybe you're right, but the fact is he hasn't. Let's work on this characteristic with him and see if we can help bring about improvement." The three of us agreed that Will's circumstances wouldn't change our judgment. Everyone has unforeseen events that come along, and the people who ultimately succeed are those who overcome them. The man who raised the issue didn't change his mind, but that's all right. We agreed to disagree. You don't always get agreement, but the more people you listen to, the better a composite you get. After one of these talent review meetings, I write a letter to each of the participants, spelling out what they agreed to do about their people. These letters are feedback essential to talent planning and building the leadership pipeline. Here are examples of the kinds of comments I make, taken from past letters. The names and jobs are changed. I make every effort to be as specific as possible and then follow through during the year. Number one, you have 1,000 engineers and have identified only 7 high potentials at band 5, a leadership position. That's not enough. You must make something happen here with your map for development combined with a learning plan as well as external hiring. Two, John X. If he continues to improve as you describe, we will look at a band 6, a higher leadership position, later in the year after the beta product is out. His people feel he plays his cards too close to the vest. It isn't wise to lead that way. Help him improve his self-confidence and be more open. Please stay close to John. Continue to work on the relationship. We want him to succeed. Three. Brad X is in over his head. He must fix his structure and hasn't filled critical roles in operations fast enough, and consequently he's failing. Reduce his scope. Find a way to help him and get him the help he needs at the same time that you keep him motivated. Four. I do not see your successor in your organization. You must develop your replacement. This is a worldwide, complicated, exciting business where we need the best people. As your business grows, some of your talent will be passed by. You must fill your pipeline now with more high-potential people and make opportunities for them. Work on your issues identified in the team effectiveness and, as an action, establish an ongoing team-building process. 5. Pete X is responsive but not proactive. Give him candid feedback. He doesn't show the passion for the role we need. 6. Julie X is close to burnout. She's been in a tough job. You must identify her successor and determine the best way to utilize her many talents. 7. Greg X is more process than results-oriented. We haven't seen the ability to pull through results. He is more knowledgeable than others, but doesn't perform. His people standards are not high enough, and he isn't demanding. His leadership skills are underdeveloped. Make sure he gets some help. 8. Mark X. His results are impressive, but he must temper his ego. Be very direct about what he needs to do to improve. 9. Todd X has nice leadership skills. The transition to Group Z hasn't been easy. I'm concerned you think he is a retention issue. He needs to know we would like to move him to a P&L role soon.
Building Block 3. Dealing with non-performers. Even the best people process doesn't always get the right people in the right jobs, and it can't make everybody into a good performer. Some managers have been promoted beyond their capabilities and need to be put in lesser jobs. Others just have to be moved out. The final test of a people process is how well it distinguishes between these two types, and how well leaders handle the painful actions they have to take.
There's one thing that wakes you up in the deep of night after you make these selections. You've all discussed someone carefully, listened to all the viewpoints, and reached a conclusion you all feel good about. But no matter how successful a person has been so far, every promotion is a new decision. You can't take it for granted that he's going to succeed in the next job. Non-performing people are essentially those who aren't meeting their established goals. They're unable on a regular basis to accomplish what they are responsible for. Or maybe they fail to exercise the leadership expected of them in a situation or a host of other things. Suppose a leader has a labor problem and the employees want to unionize. It isn't necessarily the leader's issue that it happened, but he has to take a lead role in trying to keep his company union-free. If he fails to stand up and do that convincingly and articulately and persistently, and the plant gets unionized, that's non-performance. Their failures don't mean they're bad people. It just means they aren't performing at the level that is essential for the company's success, and you deal with them quickly and fairly. For example, Rob was a good manufacturing man, and we made him a plant manager. But after a year, it became clear he was not up to the task. He hadn't fixed a bloated cost structure and hadn't filled critical roles of operation fast enough. We had to decide what to do about him. We didn't want to let Rob go. He's technically sound and good with people. So we agreed to give him a different job where we thought he could be successful, and then we'd see what his next step would be. We did that, and he's still there. Another man, Sid, did a wonderful job in his part of the world. We knew we would need a new general manager there at some point, but it would not be him. He was great at sales, but not a people leader. So we were candid with him. We told him his strong suit was customer relations, not strategy or people or operations. He knows he'll never run the business, but he's still there and doing a good job. Sometimes there's no way around it. You have to let people go. But again, you do it as constructively as you can. Let's assume I made a mistake in hiring Doug. He just wasn't ever going to work out in any capacity. I could go to him and say, Doug, you're fired. The results haven't been good. Get out of here. But if I did, he'd leave with a sour taste in his mouth. He'd deal with Honeywell somehow down the road in another job and with people who are our customers or potential customers. It wouldn't do us any good if he had nothing but bad things to say about Honeywell. Or I could call him in and say, hey, look, Doug, we've both made a mistake here. I apparently didn't explain the job to you as well as I should have. You haven't done it well. We've got to make a change, and we've got to do it in a way that you come out of this thing fine. First of all, I'm going to give you a year's salary, because this is as much my fault as it is yours. Two, I'm not going to lie when someone asks me to recommend you. I'm going to tell them you did some things wrong. But I'm certainly not going to submerge you. And three, I'm going to find ways so you can hold your head with dignity. Then he'd probably say, Larry, I want to resign. I want to say that I prefer to do something else. I'd say, we'll know that you didn't resign, but if you feel better that way, fine. Preserving the dignity of people who leave jobs is an important part of reinforcing the positive nature of the performance culture. Sometimes people recognize before you do that they aren't up to a job. After I returned to Honeywell, I didn't waste any time increasing the pace at which the company was operating. The aftermath of September 11th made the need for speed especially urgent. One of the managers came to me, one of our leaders, in October. He was in his late 50s, was a good person, and had been doing a good job. But he was not intense. He said, I don't like this fast pace or the amount of corporate interference. I want to retire at the end of the year. When I was informed about the situation, I appreciated his honesty. I'd rather have a person say that than sit there and let the results deteriorate and tell him he should retire. I told him, we've got a tough year ahead of us, and it's not going to be predictable. We'll have to do some rigorous things. You're making the right decision, and we'll be very fair with you. And we were.
Building Block 4. Linking HR to business results. If you're starting to think that human resources is less important in an execution culture, let us correct that impression. It's more important than ever, but its role has to change radically. HR has to be integrated into the business processes. It has to be linked to strategy and operations, and to the assessments that the line people ultimately make about people. In this new role, HR becomes recruitment-oriented and a far more powerful force for advancing the organization than it was in typical staff function. As Don Redlinger, the Senior Vice President of HR at Honeywell International, explains, the paradox in working for somebody like Bossidy is that he's the CFO and the Chief Human Resources Officer and the Chief Strategist. But he has such a systematic view of how you make an organization perform that human resources people prosper in that environment. He demands that the organization use all of its capabilities to make money. He says all the things to us in HR that he would to a marketing person. I want bigger margins than anybody else, and to accomplish this, we have to have great people and train them better and faster than everybody else. We need to have educational programs that are focused on key business issues and problems, the things that matter. HR's role is to help me solve these problems. One of the first things Larry did when he got to Allied Signal was to focus a lot on human resources talent. The HR function was one of the first elements of the organization we really drove to upgrade, and it gave us leverage all over the place. Things were different earlier in my career. Managers would assign HR people to recruit or to execute specific elements of a plan. For example, when they wanted to shut a plant down, you'd negotiate with the union. The nature of the HR beast today is very different. We're expected to come to the party with a point of view about how you achieve a business objective or a strategic plan, and we have a role that's very analogous to the role of a CFO. Or any other participant in the management process. The HR person not only has to be well trained in the craft, how to teach people, develop them, make them interested in staying with us, and know what's important for building momentum and morale in an organization, all of those tactical skills, but also must have the same characteristics as any business leader has. These include business acumen, the ability to understand how a company makes money, the ability to think critically, a passion for results, and the ability to link strategy and execution. The number of companies that have strong, results-oriented human resources staffs is still small, but it's growing. At Baxter International, for example, HR is central both to a rigorous process for assessing, developing, and promoting people, and to the company's strategic planning. Baxter is a global healthcare company specializing in critical therapies for people with life-threatening conditions. The company aims to double its $7 billion in revenues over the next decade by leveraging and expanding its portfolio of biologics, pharmaceuticals, medical devices, information, and services. Having the right people in the right jobs is critical to its strategy. CEO Harry M. Jansen Kramer, Jr. spent the late 1990s, when he was CFO, restructuring the company by selling off its slow growth businesses and getting its finances in order. When he was named CEO in 1999, he made the people process one of his three top priorities. The other two? Focusing on customers and patients and providing a superior return to investors. Kramer and his direct reports, who constitute the Executive Management Team, EMT, are deeply involved in people selection and development, and the company's strategic, operating, and people processes are tightly linked. Baxter's growth planners, line executives, and HR people work together to identify the specific capabilities and skills the company will need to execute its strategies over the next several years. For example, says Mike Tucker, Senior Vice President for HR, through our strategic growth planning process during 2001, we identified expertise in regulatory issues, reimbursement, and strategic clinical marketing as organization capabilities we need to enhance and build. We then established teams to flesh out the details of exactly what was needed, what capabilities we currently had, and what we needed to do to fill the gaps. Line people headed the teams. The head of Baxter's quality organization led the reimbursement initiative. The head of government affairs led the regulatory effort. And a marketing vice president led the marketing effort. Not incidentally, the leadership gave the executives valuable experience in leading cross-business, cross-geographic teams. Identifying and filling critical jobs is a key part of Baxter's strategy process. In an annual half-day review, line executives, their HR vice presidents, Kramer and Tucker, identify strategically critical positions in business units, regions, and functions, and make sure the right people are in these jobs. But the review is only part of the process. On this and other important issues, Kramer and Tucker talk informally and frequently with each other and with the business and functional leaders and their HR leaders. Critical jobs aren't necessarily high-level ones. They could be four layers down in the organization, says Tucker. For example, one might be somebody leading a clinical trial of a product where approval is critical to your strategy over the next 3 years. We'll say, okay, based on where the renal business is going over the next 3 years, what are the key things the strategy has to deliver, and which jobs are critical to executing them? Then we assess the incumbent against that skill set that's required. The logic here is that we've got positions that are critical to the strategy execution over the next 3 to 5 years. We need our best people in them. They must be identified now since the jobs are too important for us to wait and develop someone for them. It forces executives to really drill down and identify what the critical jobs are. The first year we asked managers to identify critical jobs, everybody named all of their direct reports. We had to say, wait a minute. Yes, your vice president of sales is very important, but she may not be critical to the execution of your new strategy. When we consider whether a person is right for their job, we place them in one of three categories: a good fit, a stretch, or an action required. If the person is a good fit, we just stay on top and monitor her progress. If the person is a stretch, it means we're comfortable that he can deliver, but we might need to shore him up. Maybe he's not strong on finances, so let's make sure we get a good controller for him and provide the organizational support necessary. If the person is an action required, it means that the person needs to come out of that position and leave the company, or else take a different job in the organization that she can handle. We hold the line executive in charge accountable for addressing the issue within 6 months. Senior slating, choosing candidates for the roughly 325 vice presidential positions, is the showcase of Baxter's new people process. Because it's so visible, it's really helped turn our culture around, says Tucker. Every Thursday, Tucker sends a voicemail to each of the top 150 people in the company, letting them know who has left the organization, which vice presidential positions are open, and which people have filled previously open ones. He spells out the job and candidate criteria for the open slots so the leaders can generate names for senior slating. They can put themselves up if they want to. Senior HR executives discuss the candidates at their weekly conference call the following Monday and compile an initial slate. We might have 15 names, says Tucker, and they'll go through and pare it down until they come up with a short list of those they feel are most appropriate. We have to put on our company hat in these meetings. Somebody will say, for example, "Well, we agree that Steve is a strong candidate, but his line manager's reluctant to make him available because he's really needed where he is." We have to say, "I hear you, but this job is more important from the company's standpoint, and we ought to make him available." On the flip side of the coin, we might have to say, "I know that you guys think this person ought to go in there, but we just can't afford to have her move." Vice presidents with open positions work from this slate over the next 2 or 3 days, gathering information and feedback for making assessments before making their recommendations. Tucker then takes the final slate to the next weekly EMT meeting, where it's the first item on the agenda. "The process has really speeded up slating," says Tucker. "Before we started in 1999, it took us on average about 16 weeks to fill a vice presidential position. After the second quarter this year, we're down to 7 because we're much more efficient. We've got a lot of discipline there. We follow up on it weekly. We move right through it. And the quality and breadth of the candidates is much better. It used to be that the same 5 names came up for every position. It's helped us in other ways. The executive management team has a much better knowledge of the top 150 to 300 people in the company because those are the names that are coming up as candidates. And it's helped me to open up my own lines of communication. Those voicemails I send out get sent throughout the organization. As I travel around and go into a plant or office, I'll introduce myself, and somebody will say, "Oh, yes, you're the man who leaves the voicemail." So it's helped create the open communication style that we're trying to foster. Candid dialogue, the live ammo. There's no one system for creating and maintaining a robust people process, but certain rules are needed: integrity, honesty, a common approach, common language, and frequency. Above all, candid dialogue is critical. It's what Duke Energy's Vice President of Human Resources, Chris Rolfe, calls the live ammo in the people process. It is fundamentally the social software of the people process. Duke is a $49 billion, as of the end of 2000, producer, transporter, and manager of diverse energy sources. Like Baxter, Duke had to head into a new strategic direction after deregulation of the power business in the 1990s made its old utility model obsolete. Just from generating and selling power, Duke gradually developed a strategy that includes a mixture of physical assets, such as power plants and pipelines, buying and selling natural gas and electricity on the marketplace, and financial operations such as risk management. Achieving the new model required a new mix of people. Says Rolf, when our chairman, Rick Priory, asked us to do our first company-wide assessment in early 1998, we could see we didn't have all the talent we needed to execute the strategy, and maybe not to beat some of our fiercest competitors. In general, the DNA of the people who can execute the new model is fundamentally different from the DNA of people who run a regulated monopoly. Certainly there's an operational component, but there are also tremendous financial components, merchant components, risk assessment, and marketing components. In 1999, Duke began to build a new people process. One of the first questions was, what would the process look like, says Rolf. We went through a pretty rigorous process of defining competencies. We started talking with a small group of our executives to build a framework for evaluating. Then we gave a validation test to our top 500 executives and came out with correlations on these competencies, basically as high as the third-party firm who advised us had ever seen. That is, they were accurate predictors of business success in the new business model. We call this people development and assessment model the successful executive at Duke. The Duke team identified four basic groups of competencies: functional skills, business skills, management skills, and leadership skills. For example, says Rolf, who was an engineer before moving into human resources, let's say Duke is considering hiring me as an HR executive. I have to have technical HR background, knowing ERISA, staffing, training, compensation, and such. These are functional skills. I have to have business skills, too, like understanding Duke's business model and how it makes money. Three, I have to be able to manage. Management skills are an important criterion at Duke, because the operations leg of our model means management, planning, organizing, directing, and controlling work. Finally, there are the leadership skills. Duke would ask, does Chris have the fundamental leadership capabilities to be a senior executive at this enterprise? It took us about a year to assess our people against these groups of competencies. What we came out with, beyond assessment tools and those types of things, was what I call a common language, a common way of talking about people. So now we don't just say, he's a good guy, or she's really smart. We say, we don't see in this person the ability to operationalize, or that person is primarily operational and doesn't seem to have the strategic perspective. Because Duke is largely decentralized, Rolf centralized only three components of the human resources process: compensation for the approximately top 200 people, domestic benefits, and a global web-based HR data system. We tried some of the rigor, for example, of a GE Session C, but with a less systematic, standardized, one-size-fits-all approach, because of our different governance model. The data system is critical for that rigor, and we spent a lot of time and money on it. Very few companies have one system for the entire enterprise, particularly those that have done a series of mergers and acquisitions. But when I talked to companies like GE, they told me, above all else, you'd better get that piece right, because the fundamental question is, who works here? And without one global system, you cannot answer that question. One benefit of the system is its usefulness in succession planning. We began populating a global database of executive CVs. It was a common system that linked into our payroll, equity, and security systems, so we could produce what I lovingly refer to as baseball cards. 1 8.5 by 11, with pictures, compensation, personnel information, and assessments for every senior executive. Now when we talk about someone, the data is right in front of us, and we're all talking from the same sheet of paper, with not just a name, but degrees, career interests, developmental plans, associations, third-party assessments if we've got those things, what his or her current compensation is, what it has been. Managers also do what we call a retention assessment, which would be a 3x3 matrix of the criticalness of a particular individual's role and their assessment of whether they think she's going to stay over the next 5 years, low, medium, high. So if you were a lethargic human resources executive, for example, who probably wasn't going anywhere and was adding very little value to the company, you'd be a low risk of turnover. But if you were a hotshot financial MBA who could run a business and could be attractive to other companies, you'd be assessed as a high risk of turnover. So everywhere on the globe, we have one approach, one system, computer-based, feeding into a common database. I call that getting rid of the Tower of Babel. We are all on one page. The system's hardware is only the foundation of the people process. The critical software, the live ammo, is in the dialogues of the organization, the process of observation to common criteria, culminating in candid assessment and feedback. HR can build all these elaborate systems, but it takes the leader of the company to make it real, coupled, in our case, with the marketplace and a fundamental shortage of skills. Rick Priory taught the enterprise how to be brutally honest, and he started normalizing an understanding of, in his phrase, what good looks like. Say my boss turned in an assessment on me, and he said, "Chris walks on water," on each of these competencies. The chairman would say, "I know Chris. He does not walk on water in any of these, for heaven's sake. In fact, he's barely competent in these two. He's average in these 8, and he's pretty good in these 4. Rick holds us to standards of performance that are as aggressive and accountable as I have seen. Compared with our peers, we have some of the better metrics around: return on equity, return on assets, earnings growth, and so on. But if you look at our bonus payments, we rank below average. How can that be? The answer is that we have a culture of accountability. Rick is so tough about delivering the numbers in the right way, of course, that everybody knows that without the right people, you're just not going to get there. So I keep talking about live ammo in the marketplace. There is so much pressure on people to perform that nice round words become a luxury you can't afford anymore. The main social operating mechanism for Duke Energy is Priory's Policy Committee, which consists of him, the heads of the 3 major business segments, and the heads of the 4 major staff functions: legal, finance, administration, and risk. The group meets biweekly for a full day and talks formally about people and talent 3 or 4 times a year. But much of the work gets done in the biweekly meetings. "It's much more ongoing and real time," says Rolf. "We're updating these plans every day because our organization is so dynamic. And because it's on a computer-based system, it all feeds into the new succession and talent assessment on the spot." Rick's collegial management style includes people in the committee holding one another mutually accountable. No politics, no BS. Everyone's opinion is important. It's not a democracy, but they'll debate an issue, kick it around, and there's usually 1 or 2 folks who, no matter what the issue is, an acquisition, a divestiture, a business decision, will call a spade a spade. And that's the culture here. This is the social software that makes the system at Duke Energy work. Rolf ticks off the 4 elements. 1, a culture of accountability for high performance, which makes you demand the best individuals in your organization. 2, a leader who is not only willing but also ready to question an assessment. 3, a collegial culture among the top executives of the enterprise, where they hold each other mutually accountable to be reasonable and fair, and will push back on one another, just as the chairman will push back. And 4, giving me, as the head of HR, the right to push too. because I have a fundamentally different perspective because of the work I do. I'm not a small executive of the company, but I'm certainly not these folks' peers. But when I make an observation, everybody listens to me because it's not about rank. It's about the credibility and the perspective of the individual. The right people are in the right jobs when information about individuals is collected constantly and leaders know the people, how they work together, and whether they deliver results or fail to. It's the consistency of practice that develops expertise in appraising and choosing the right people. The people process begins with one-on-one assessments, but when developed and practiced as a total process, it becomes incredibly effective as an execution tool. We now turn our attention to the strategy process. It's related to the people process, above all, because strategy comes from the minds of people. If a company has the right people, in all likelihood, its strategies will be in sync with the realities of the marketplace, the economy, and the competition. Chapter 7. The Strategy Process. Making the Link with People and Operations. The basic goal of any strategy is simple enough: to win the customer's preference and create a sustainable competitive advantage while leaving sufficient money on the table for shareholders. It defines a business's direction and positions it to move in that direction. Why then do so many strategies fail? Few understand that a good strategic planning process also requires the utmost attention to the hows of executing the strategy. A robust strategy is not a compilation of numbers or what amounts to an astrological forecast when companies extrapolate numbers year by year for the next 10 years. Its substance and detail must come from the minds of the people who are closest to the action and who understand their markets, their resources, and their strengths and weaknesses. A contemporary strategic plan must be an action plan that business leaders can rely on to reach their business objectives. In creating it, you as a leader have to ask whether and how your organization can do the things that are needed to achieve its goals. Developing such a plan starts with identifying and defining the critical issues behind the strategy. How is your business positioned in the context of its business environment, including its market opportunities and threats, and its competitive advantages and disadvantages? Once you have developed the plan, you need to ask, how good are the assumptions upon which the plan hinges? What are the pluses and minuses of the alternatives? Do you have the organizational capability to execute the plan? What do you need to do in the near and medium terms to make the plan work in the long run? Can you adapt the plan to rapid changes in the business environment? To have realism in your strategy, you have to link it to your people process. Do you have the right people in place to execute the strategy? If not, how are you going to get them? You've got to link your strategic plan specifics to your operating plan, so that the moving multiple parts of the organization are aligned to get you where you want to go. The importance of the hows. If a strategy does not address the hows, it is a candidate for failure. This is a mistake to which AT&T fell victim. When Michael Armstrong came in as CEO in 1997, the company's major source of profit was long-distance voice and data, and to a lesser but growing degree, wireless. AT&T's balance sheet was clean, its debt was low, and its stock price was around $44. But external conditions were changing. Long-distance rates were falling as new rivals entered the business. Wall Street was granting higher price-earnings ratios to dot-coms and cable companies on the belief that they were positioned for much stronger growth. Armstrong set out to create a strategy that would put his company into the new growth markets. AT&T's opportunities, he concluded, lay in offering